Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, a presidential campaign blitz. Candidates running for the White House barnstorm the state. We have you covered on the highlights. Plus, state election officials reject challenges seeking to remove third-party candidates on Wisconsin's presidential ballot. And after two municipalities in Waukesha County vote to prohibit absentee ballot drop boxes, will we see more communities follow in their footsteps? All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for August 30th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We'll begin with, once again, Wisconsin in the national spotlight this week with a series of visits ranging from the former president to his running mate, J.D. Vance. And then we're also going to look ahead to Democrats hitting the campaign trail next week starting on Labor Day. So let's first start with the latest that happened on Thursday, which was former President Donald Trump hosting a town hall in La Crosse. About upwards to 8,000 people packed the arena there at the La Crosse Center. And this was his first visit to Western Wisconsin this election cycle, which is a key swing district that for a very long time was reliably red, but has been trickling a little bit blue, like the city of La Crosse, largely because of the college campus in that area. When it comes to topics, the first thing right off the bat that he was asked about was in vitro fertilization after he talked about protecting IVF just a little bit earlier when he was in another battleground state of Michigan. The former president said that he wants to protect it by either having the government or insurance companies cover the cost of the service, which is very expensive for those who are not familiar with it. Let's first just take a listen to what he had to say about that, and then we'll get into a little bit more about other issues that he touched on.
I've been seeing a lot of IVF, and I kept hearing that I'm against it, and I'm actually very much for it. In fact, in Alabama, where the judge ruled against it, and I countered the judge and came out with a very strong statement for it, and the Alabama...
You were very quick in your response to that.
I was, but they were too. They were amazing. The legislature approved virtually my statement. I mean, full IVF, and it has really gone. It's horrific. And I said, so with the tips and with the Social Security, the no taxes on Social Security, I said, maybe for IVF, and I've been looking at it, and what we're going to do is for people that are using IVF, which is fertilization, the government is going to pay for it, or we're going to get or mandate your insurance company to pay for it, which is going to be great. We're going to do that.
I can't tell you how life-changing that would be for so many families, because it costs a lot of money. A lot of people go into debt just for the hope of being able to start their own family.
Well, it's big, and you know what? We want to produce babies in this country, right? We want to produce babies.
He was also asked from four voters in the audience. It was a brief town hall due to severe weather that was hitting the area. So four voters asked about the economy, inflation, some foreign policy, of course, all issues that are very important to voters this election cycle. Oftentimes, like Trump likes to do, he didn't sometimes answer the question directly, but he used it as kind of talking about his campaign rhetoric. He hit Vice President Kamala Harris's running mate, Tim Walz, calling he's the weird guy, not me, I'm not weird. Of course, that was a popular saying by Walz that kind of went viral before actually Harris picked him to be the nominee.
So looking at Western Wisconsin, so La Crosse, the city has been reliably Democratic. You start pulling back out to the third district in general, and Trump won that district in 2016 and 2020. In 2022 with Governor Evers, won it narrowly. So it's swingy. This is a place where Trump is expected to do well. Could help Derek Van Orden in his reelection bid. Look at the places where they're going. J.D. Vance is in Kenosha. Some symbolism there, the violent protest from 4 years ago, kind of a memory of a lot of people for Kenosha. Also, that county is changing. It was once reliably blue, but as more people are moving in from Illinois and other things are happening, the county is getting more swingy, turning a little bit red. So there's a reason to go to these places to jazz people up, but also to leave a mark in a place where you want to do well. The map of Wisconsin is a puzzle in a lot of ways. It's not just about like winning the third district. It's your numbers in the third district. Can you get enough of a turnout for your base for Trump to offset the losses you're going to have in the suburbs of Milwaukee, in Madison, in Dane County. So there's a kind of a complicated math for these guys to figure out how to win the state of Wisconsin when we have such narrow margins every time.
Right, and La Crosse County specifically, you gave some margins there of how it's kind of flipped all over the place. But 2016, 2020, Trump won the third congressional district. But if you look at just La Crosse County, it was red, but then it flipped blue to Joe Biden in 2020. And that is something that I asked the GOP chair of the La Crosse County party about. And she knows just really what's at stake this election. And she believes that they can make some inroads in there. But what is the uphill battle is, like what I mentioned before, is the college campuses that have been typically leaning a little bit more Democratic. I'm not saying all college campuses, but that's how they have an edge with young students. Now let's highlight J.D. Vance's visit. You mentioned he was in Kenosha last week. Well, the week prior was also in Wisconsin. Boom, 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 boom. Yeah. I mean, the last 4 weeks he's been here, and we're told by the Trump campaign that is going to be the norm from here on out. It's either going to be Trump or it's going to be Vance in the state every single week. Well, why? Because we're almost 2 months out to the election. So Vance was in De Pere, which is kind of the Green Bay area market. There he was asked about the news of the day that we're going to talk a little bit about in the next slide, about Robert F. Kennedy dropping out of the presidential race. He called that a frustrating move, kind of knocked Democrats for it, but there is a state law that after he filed nomination papers, his name cannot be removed. Other common themes: crime, the economy, kind of the status quo when it comes to that stuff when they're in those areas.
That map again, so the wow counties we've known for 25 years in Wisconsin: Waukesha, Ozaukee, Washington, Milwaukee suburbs. Now we have the bow counties, Brown, Outagamie, Winnebago. They become more prominent. You're hitting piece of the pie, the map, the puzzle for Vance that Republicans want to do well up there to help them maybe win Wisconsin.
And looking ahead to next week, we got Tim Walz campaigning with his wife, Gwen. They'll be in Milwaukee on Monday, which is Labor Day, and I think I could put all my money on it, you and I, JR, that he will likely be speaking at Labor Day Fest, which is a big one that happens every year in Milwaukee on the Summerfest grounds. It's something that we've seen a lot of politicians almost every year talk at. It was 2020 that we saw Joe Biden have an event there celebrating unions. Likely Tim Walz is going to do the same thing. And then, oh, by the way, looking ahead to Thursday, President Biden will be back in the state the first time since he was knocked off the ticket, or stepped down, from the presidential ticket. And we're hearing that he's going to be southwest Wisconsin, but not really any details on where yet.
Again, that puzzle, Milwaukee, is important for Democrats. Jeff, turnout, labor, an important piece of the pie for voter pie for Democrats. Southwestern Wisconsin, trying to guess where it's going to be.
Right.
College campus, you mentioned. Well, you know about the third district in western Wisconsin there, I think half dozen college campuses. It's a reason why Democrats, after Biden dropped out and Harris replaced him, felt more excited about that district because they see an opportunity to turn out college kids in those six campuses and maybe neutralize some of the Trump advantage from 2020 and 2016.
All right, now let's move ahead to what candidates are going to appear on the November presidential ballot after the State Elections Commission approved three third-party candidates to remain on the ballot after all three of them were challenged, some by Democrats, some by Republicans. So looking at your screen here, Robert F. Kennedy, he's an independent, he'll be on the candidate. Green Party candidate, Jill Stein, she'll be on the ballot, and Cornell West, an independent as well. Now, West was a Democrats tried to file a complaint. They rejected a complaint against him, arguing his nomination papers were not in compliance with state law. Moving on to Jill Stein, this was literally a day after the state Supreme Court declined to hear a case that also challenged to seek to remove her off the ballot. There was another one filed by Democrats that was rejected as well. And then looking at Robert F. Kennedy, I mean, he dropped out. We were talking about it here live on the show last week. He stepped down, endorsed former President Donald Trump, then tried to file a complaint. Can I please remove my name? But unfortunately, once you file these nomination papers and you are a qualified candidate to be on the ballot, there's no remedy. You're basically stuck, and you're going to have to remain on the ballot, which, even with Jill Stein and Kennedy are the main two, there are fears among both sides across the political spectrum that fear that these two individuals could take votes away from them, and of course a state where we have razor-thin margins in a lot of statewide elections.
So let's talk about them separately, because Stein had different process on the ballot than Kennedy. So Stein, like the Constitutional Libertarian Party, Republican Party, and Democratic Party, has ballot access because they qualify for various benchmarks. There's a law in Wisconsin that says if you are a party on the presidential ballot, you're supposed to have a meeting the first Tuesday in October, I believe it is, before the election, to have your office holders select your electors. Remember, you're voting in Wisconsin, you pick essentially the candidate, but that candidate's electors cast electoral votes for Wisconsin in the presidential electoral college. Well, Greens have nobody who qualifies to meet that meeting. You have to be an office holder or a candidate for the Assembly of the Senate. There's nobody there for them, Libertarians, or the Constitution Party. So the argument was, both in the Supreme Court case and before the commission this week, was they shouldn't be in the ballot because they can't meet the law. Now, we have these laws in Wisconsin that are, some are mandatory. Some are kind of treated like, well, we want you to get there, but if you don't, we're not going to boot you off the ballot because of it. I know it seems kind of odd, but there's a slight difference between how some of these statutes are treated. The question was, one, is this law mandatory? And two, is it constitutional? The mandatory piece, in 2016, the Greens had the same problem, and nobody raised a fuss about it. The constitutional piece, which Don Millis, a GOP appointee, raised, was, look, you're adding basically another hurdle for third-party candidates to qualify for the ballot. There are some concerns that wouldn't stand up to judicial scrutiny, number one. So you had the two of the three Democratic appointees vote against putting Stein, the Constitution, and Libertarian parties on the ballot, but the Democratic clerk joined Republicans to pass that 4-2. Now, Kennedy went the independent route, which is filing nomination papers. That, you don't have to have the whole lecture thing. That process, though, like you said, once you submit the papers, you can't withdraw them. What was interesting was Republicans have complained for years that the members of the Elections Commission who are Democrats treat the law as what they want it to be, not what it actually says, right? We hear that complaint all the time.
Yes.
That, oh, this thing is so stacked against us, the Democrats aren't being, you know, true to the law. Well, you had Don Millis, again, GOP appointee, saying, I don't like this law. I can't wrap my head around the idea that we're going to force somebody on the ballot who wants to be off. I'm going to make a motion to allow him to be off the ballot. And Ann Jacobs, a Democratic appointee, was like, you can't do that. The law is the law. Like, what are we doing here?
Yeah.
You're giving this touchy-feely thing, Don, about what you want the law to be. So on the one hand, it underscores, look, this commission is partisan. These guys act with partisan interest when they do things. But for Kennedy, the question now becomes, and Stein too, what's the impact in November? So let's pull back to like past elections. In 2016, Jill Stein, 31,000 votes, the margin between Trump and Clinton, 22,000 and change. But it's not fair to say Stein's the reason why Clinton lost. It kind of takes the onus off of Clinton for a poor campaign. Didn't come here
right.
at all
mm-hmm.
after the primary in 2016. Also, there was a lot of enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton among Democrats at that election. So is she the spoiler? Maybe, maybe not. This time, would she be? I've been talking to Democrats say that if Joe Biden were the nominee this fall still, that'd cause more concern, right? Because there wasn't the enthusiasm we're seeing for Harris for Biden. So maybe now with Kennedy, he's still on the ballot. Will he pull people away from Trump? Because in the last Marquette poll, 10% of Republicans said they were voting for Kennedy, 4% of Democrats. So a little more of a pull from Trump. Well, go back to 2022. There was a woman named Joan Benglinger who launched her campaign to protest COVID policies and in favor of election integrity. She dropped out, remember, endorsed Tim Michaels, but there were groups, we think they were favorable to Tony Evers, who did ad, like mail, saying she's the real conservative. Now, is she the reason why Tim Michaels lost? No. But she got like 31,000 votes or 30,000 votes, something like that. So there's an example of him being on the ballot will pull some people. Is it enough to like tip the balance? Don't know.
Who knows, right?
And the bottom line too is, if you're Harris or Trump, if your fate in Wisconsin is tied to like Jill Stein or Robert F. Kennedy, you probably have bigger problems.
I was just going to say, yeah.
Right?
Right.
So for Democrats especially, if you're losing Wisconsin by 10,000 votes or whatever Jill Stein were to get, you're probably not winning Michigan. You've probably got problems in Pennsylvania. You're not winning at least the Sun Belt states.
Mm-hmm.
So that's your kind of ball of wax. There are bigger problems than just Jill Stein, but you've got to keep an eye on her.
All right. Absolutely. Okay. We're now going to move on to absentee ballot drop boxes. I wouldn't call it a trend yet, but it could be a trend related to municipalities voting to not have voters use them in the upcoming November election. So two Waukesha County municipalities in the past 2 weeks, Brookfield and New Berlin, have decided to prevent residents from using absentee ballot drop boxes in November. Now, in the spring of 2021, to put this in perspective, the Wisconsin Elections Commission found that were 570 drop boxes being used in 66 out of the 72 counties in Wisconsin. Now, we have asked the Wisconsin Elections Commission how many are in use now. They are not keeping track of that, they said. That's up to local municipalities. And once again, this is local control. These are their decisions. But this comes as Republicans have been really frustrated ever since the state Supreme Court reinstated them. They have tried to talk some voters out of it. But in a sense, if they're there, they're there. People are going to use them. But there's still some scrutiny over, are they being monitored? Are there security in place? Of course, it wasn't too long ago that WEC passed a series of guidelines, best practices for clerks to follow if they wanted to use them. So what we're kind of watching for, JR, is how many other communities might do this. Of course, time is kind of running out. Ballots are going to be printed soon in the next few weeks. But it is something that maybe more people will decide to do through city council.
And Republicans, they're trying to encourage people to vote via the mail. They want to level the playing field because they say, look, these are the tools in the toolbox. You've heard that from Brian Schimming, the state judiciary, multiple times. We have to use every tool in the toolbox. Well, these communities are taking a tool out of the toolbox for Republicans without a way to return their ballots via Dropbox. So are you unleveling the playing field, if you will, because you have such concerns about these being used or don't like the fact they're being used, that you actually hurt the cause for the GOP by not embracing them?
All right. Okay, let's move on to the next topic this weekend. It's about a new audit that the Joint Legislative Audit Committee approved on party lines yesterday, which was 5-4, which would order an audit to analyze the Department of Public Instruction's monitoring of school district finances. And this comes after there was financial issues at Milwaukee Public Schools. But it also comes as we've learned that the Monona Grove School District has a deficit for the past 3 years. And most recently, the Wauwatosa School District faces now a $4 million shortfall due to miscalculations. Let's first hear from members on the audit committee, kind of their reasoning behind this, which was Republicans want more oversight. Democrats say really not necessary because Governor Evers already has one underway for MPS, but this one would be more broad. So let's take a listen.
Like all of our audits, and unlike the governor's audit, we will give LAB some initial direction on what we want to investigate, and that's it. They will follow the trail wherever it leads and not coordinate with us until after they're done investigating and they've prepared their report.
As we heard, the primary responsibility, of course, is with local government. I believe in local control and local responsibility. A lot of people have lost their jobs over what happened in Milwaukee. And finally, I think we should think of the taxpayers. This is duplication of services, duplication of effort. And so I will be voting against this. Thank you.
Now, like I mentioned right before this video, Governor Evers is already moving forward with a plan to audit MPS after there was a lot of miscalculations that got a lot of news over the past few months after the district failed to submit key financial data to the state, which led DPI to withhold funding from them. Now, that's the big question for Wauwatosa and some other of these school districts, but almost could be, in a sense, a bigger problem that's going on, not at just a few of these districts. This could be going elsewhere as well.
Also worth noting that the committee approved an audit of Fish and Wildlife Fund. There's a possible deficit there in that they're going to keep an eye on.
All right, let's move on to the next topic, which is already about another secretary dropping out of the Evers administration, someone that's been there for a very long time. And we're talking about Department of Children and Family Services. Department of Children's and Families Secretary Emily Edmundson. She'll leave her position on September 1st. Of course, the Evers already appointed the deputy secretary to take over that role. Now, Edmundson previously served as chief of staff for Governor Tony Evers as his former role as state superintendent. So this duo has known each other for a very long time.
Yeah, so I also have to correct from last week. I was wrong that Craig Thompson would be the last original member. Emily also was original member from the Evers administration from January 2019. So they're both going out at the same time. This will be a turnover of the full term of the Evers administration then from his first days in office. Now, we are closing in on end of year six of Evers being in office. Most governors I've covered have significant turnover in the course of their terms. We're getting to the point where people who, no offense to their backgrounds, but they're kind of more like they've been part of the agency or like Evers worked with Jeff Pirtle for a long time, for example. They kind of rise up. If you go back to 2019, a lot of people came from the private sector, right, to be Evers cabinet secretaries. Every administration I've covered gets to this cycle of, like, you go through all these people who come in from outside. They go, you know what? I can make more money doing something else. I need fewer headaches in the private sector. I'm going to go back. And then you get this cycle that's going on right now.
Well, you also have to think of if he runs again, you never know. But if he doesn't, there's only 2 years left. So if you want something long term, sometimes an administration is not the best position because after every 4 years, of course, a governor, there's a governor's election. So definitely something that's interesting that now almost everything, like you said, all the positions that were with him since day one have now all cleared out of his cabinets, and a lot of new faces, fresh faces in that administration. All right, let's get to stocks this week. And of course, we're going to dive into some numbers, which is your favorite part here, JR, which is revenue collections, more good news, an uptick compared to the previous projections about our revenue.
Yeah, so it's always good news when more money's coming in. Dive the numbers a little bit. There are a couple of interesting things to note. One, the economy is still growing, which is why we're seeing increases in corporate and income taxes. Two, inflation is slowing, which is why we're seeing a little bit of a dip in sales taxes. And three, we still drink lots of beer in Wisconsin. And so let me explain all that. So LFB, the Fiscal Bureau, does projections every so often, like what they think will come in to help lawmakers and the governor keep track of what's going on. With this look, it's the final look of 2023-2024, the first year of the budget. Looking at that, they projected growth of growth this year became a little bit higher than expected. Okay, great. Looking at it, corporate taxes income drove the increase for the most part. Sales taxes down a little bit in various things, but we kind of knew that already. We saw that with some studies from like Wisconsin Policy Forum talk about locals, how Milwaukee, for example, is not getting as much of a thought the sales tax. And we also have excise taxes, tobacco, cigarettes, vaping products, alcohol. Of those excise taxes, beer, only one that came in higher.
All right, way to go, Wisconsin.
worth noting that tobacco taxes were down. Now, that's good news, bad news. It's bad news in terms of revenue, but also good news in terms of health. So you may save some money in the back end in health programs. This is all one piece of the puzzle. The next step is in mid-October, we'll get the annual fiscal report from the state. That'll add the spending component, right? So it's not just how much you bring in, it's how much you spend as well. That'll give us a final closure on 23-24. Also an update on the surplus that we have, about $3.15 billion last check. And then in November, we get the big report, which is all the agency requests for new spending, a projection of what's gonna happen going forward, and kind of a little more look at like what's happened to date. That's gonna set the stage for the 25-27 budget. We have, again, $3.15 billion roughly that we think is a surplus. We also have that rainy day fund, which we're not gonna be touched anytime soon. So if you add just a $277 million more, okay, that's a little bit more money to play with. We can come in handy because remember, UW has asked for $855 million more for the next 2 years. Now, I don't think they're gonna get that from my conversation with Republicans.
I don't remember the last time they got exactly all they asked for, right.
Republicans haven't been big fans of the system lately, but you're going to see a huge ask from DPI, public construction, for more money. That's been an Evers priority. How is he going to go about with tax cuts, if any? Where are his priorities? And oh, by the way, how's the legislature look come January? That could shape the Evers ask, because for the governor, if he has big Republican majorities in both houses, he's not going to get much done, much like the last couple budgets.
Right.
But if you flip the assembly, which is possible, then you have a much different dynamic for that budget going forward, and you make it more aggressive from Evers, what he asked for.
All right, let's get to MIX, which is the Department of Public Construction, because Governor Evers, the state Supreme Court ruled that he was proper in using his veto pen related to a literacy reading bill.
Yeah, so this is going to be a little complicated. I'll try and be slow here, but so governors have the most powerful veto pen. Well, Wisconsin governors have one of the most powerful pens in the country when it comes to vetoes. They can only, though, use it on an appropriation bill, which spends money. Mm-hmm. There's a lawsuit filed in Dane County Court by lawmakers, Republicans, saying, look, the governor vetoed a non-appropriation bill. What happened was lawmakers become more and more prone to breaking spending up from the policy. This was the literacy program. They want to go to a phonics-based system in Wisconsin. We've had struggles with reading scores, right? So this new system was set up. It actually spread over like three different bills. There was funding from the budget. There was like policy. And then a bill that provided the framework to spend $50 million once DPI asked the Joint Finance Committee, controlled by Republicans, for the funds. So Evers vetoed some of the policy in that bill. Republicans said, you can't do that. It's not a spending bill. Mm-hmm. Judge Elke, Dane County judge, said, well, actually, I have to consider this all as a package. There are three bills here. I've got to look at it as a package because otherwise, the lawmakers have balkanized, in his words, the process, which is true. Republicans want to balkanize the process. They want to protect their policy from governor's veto pen. They've done this repeatedly last 6 years. Now, DPI during this process said, hey, while you're taking this lawsuit, Judge Elke, you should make Joint Finance release a $50 million because since the governor vetoed partially that bill, they will release the money. We can't pay for this program. Elke said, look, the process with joint finance is okay by my book, so I'm not going to compel them to spend the money. Now we've erased the appeals court. Typically in Wisconsin, the first appeal filed is the court gets the first appeal, is the one that hears everything. The governor, immediately after this decision came down this week, went to the first district in Milwaukee. It's a liberal court. Republicans went to the Waukesha-based Second District Court of Appeals. It's a conservative court. They got beat by a few minutes. Now there's a little legal wrangling going on where lawmakers are saying, hey, the governor's filing was incomplete. You should toss it out, first district, and have the second district hear this. Which in the end, the thing is, once you the state Supreme Court, they'll ultimately decide all this stuff. And there's a showdown maybe coming over this whole process where Republicans keep putting money in one bill, policy in another, and put money in Joint Finance Committee saying, okay, agencies, you can come get it, but only after you get our approval for it.
And it's because they still want their kind of their hands on that money too, even though the governor has the ultimate say if a bill passes or not. All right, let's get to Falling This Week, which is kind of a lot of news that you've been tracking, JR, about the Voss recall. Of course, the news is after they striked out with SCOTUS, but now you've looked through some of their finance reports too and had some questions raised there.
So they should have filed this report back in mid-July, but it took them until now to file it. And getting my hands on it, you see, okay, they raised more than $1.3 million for their effort to recall Robin Voss over two efforts. Remember, both failed. They also spent about $1.3 million. Robin Voss has said over and over again, this is an out-of-state effort driven by out-of-state interests, not grassroots. Well, he kind of has a point, according to his reports. First, the money, about 94%, came from an Arkansas philanthropist, so not Wisconsin-based money to fund everything. Two, most of the money was spent, at least more than half it was spent, on called solicitation expenses. Now, I'm a dork about finance reports. I've admitted that many times. That category is not defined in state law, okay? So, but I see it all the time. When it's not defined in state law for KMA finance purposes, you go to the common law meaning, which means basically to solicit, to try and get something, right? Mm-hmm. So, a number of the organizers on the recall committees got paid solicitation expenses. One guy who's the driving force got paid $20,000. So on the one hand, you go, okay, was this supposed to be like wages, like campaign wages? You see it all the time, which is totally fine. You can pay a wage to work on a campaign. But then I saw other entries marked campaign wages. So why are these guys getting $500,000 in solicitation expenses? Then they also listed like hotel expenses as solicitation expenses. And so you kind of start going, do these guys know what they're doing in filing these reports? Never mind that they're late, but are they filing them properly?
Right.
Two, we both saw Michael Gableman represent the recall committee before the Elections Commission. There was no expenses for compliance, which is a catch-all word in campaign finance world for, having an attorney work for you, checking your reports, going before the Elections Commission. Nada. No payments to Gableman at all, unless it's buried under some LLC that I couldn't figure out was tied to him. That was kind of interesting. So anyway, the reports paint an interesting picture about a gang that couldn't shoot straight, now might not be filing the right reports.
Right.
This all comes as they through this Hail Mary to the Supreme Court of Wisconsin saying, we want you to take our appeal and argue, have order a recall election before November. That wasn't going to happen, and the court, no surprise, rejected that this week.
Right, so it's almost their third kind of hurdle.
Strike four,
But the thing is, I think there's still always going to be a thorn in Robin Voss's in his head, because they're not going anywhere. So this is something that we'll continue to track. All right, that will do it this week for the show. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We'll see you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.